So, in North Carolina, if you would come visit in North Carolina, we have one of the most dangerous coasts in the world. Not because it's so stormy, but because it's so shallow. The coast is very, very, very gradual as it goes out to the Atlantic shelf where it drops off into really deep water. But on the shallow, shallow gradient coming in there, the ships that have to come in on this shallow, in the shallow water are in tremendous danger because the water is shallow. They're barely clearing the bottom of the water. I mean, here's the bottom of the ocean, here's the water, and here's the ship. Right? Problem is, when you're easing along in shallow water like this, when you have a storm and the waves start going like this, your ship hits the ground and breaks apart, and you're still miles off the beach, and you die. That's the normal method for that. So to help with this method, they have lighthouses up and down the shore, and they're beautiful lighthouses, and they're useful. I'm going to tell you about two of them. One of these lighthouses is my favorite lighthouse along the whole coast, and very few people know about it. It's a little wooden lighthouse along Lake Matamuskee. Lake Matamuskee is a little lake. Here's the sound. This is all ocean sound, goes on forever until you get to England. And then there is a little canal that goes in exactly straight off the sound through the swamp and gets to a gigantic lake inland here. This is Lake Matamuskee. And they used to drain this lake dry every year and farm it. Some of the best farmland in the world, thick black peat soil. But all around this lake is swamp, deep, impenetrable swamp. Now there's a few roads, but back in the day there weren't. And so they dug this canal with a tremendous amount of blood, sweat, and tears to carry the crops that they grew through this channel into the sound. Well, the sound is about 3 feet deep, and then it gets to be about 4 feet deep, about 2 miles out. And then it gets to be about 5 feet deep, about 4 miles out. And then it goes probably another 20 miles at about that depth. Right? So from the end of this canal, there is a straight channel dredged in the swamp, in the sound, all the way out until you get to the deep water. Right? The lighthouse sits right here and shines its light straight down this channel. It's a low lighthouse made of wood, and the light, and this is all swamp here, gigantic cypress trees. You can't see the lighthouse unless you're exactly in line with the channel. Right? You can be 20 miles in the ocean and you sail back and forth until you see the light. And when you see the light, you know you're in the channel and you can sail straight in, keeping the light exactly in front of you. You lose sight of the light, you're out of the channel. Keep the light directly in front of you until you sail all the way into the through the canal and into the lake. My favorite lighthouse. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. The other lighthouse is not operating anymore. There's the Bodie Island Lighthouse, and it's called the Bodie Island because there was a family called Bodie. The last name was Bodie that owned the island. And they had a lighthouse on this island for the exact same reason. Not quite the exact same reason. Here's the coast of North Carolina. And out here's the Outer Banks, a series of islands. Here is a little gap between two islands. And there's the same channel situation here. Really, really rough seas. The lighthouse is here, showing you where the channel is, right? Boats are sailing back and forth out here. See this lighthouse. Recognized by the number of blinks it gives, which we're out to take it, and they can take it through this little gap. Very dangerous piece of ocean. Well, back in the day, there were some pirates who figured out that they would wait until a dark and stormy night when it was sort of hard to tell where everything was, and they would climb up that Bodie Island lighthouse, and they would put the light out. And then they would take a horse and tie a big, bright lantern to its neck and lead it up to the top of the dunes, and they would wait. And they would watch the ocean until they saw the lights of a ship coming in. They'd seen the light and they were coming in, and then they would start leading the horse along the dunes, and the ship would follow, curving away from the channel,
until it crashed into the beach and the boat sunk, and the pirates were ready with their longboats, and they killed every single person every single time so that the story wouldn't get out, and took all their stuff. And it was just another of the graveyard of the Atlantic's problems. Well, eventually somebody wised up to this whole situation, and instead of sending this innocent little merchant vessel into to make this gap, they sent a boat chock full of Marines. And when the pirates came out there to catch them, the Marines jumped out and killed every single one of the pirates. And then they went up on the beach and they killed the horse with the lantern around its neck, and they planted its head on a post on the beach, and they christened it Nag's Head. And if you come to the Outer Banks in North Carolina, you will probably visit Nag's Head. And that is where that story came from. So we have here two fires, two lights. And today we're talking about igniting a fire. But before we talk about igniting a fire, I want to talk to you about different kinds of fire. One kind of fire here was life-saving and good. It helped people come to safety. The other kind of fire cost people their lives, cost them everything they have. We are all on fire. You can't help but be on fire. But what kind of fire are you burning with? Hitler was on fire, and he lit a huge section of the world on fire with a fire of darkness and destruction and pain and suffering. Paul was on fire, and he lit the world with Jesus. I challenge you today, be filled with Jesus Christ. There's nothing more important in your classroom than you being filled with Jesus Christ. And then be in the channel. Be in the light. And I want you to imagine with me the stormy sound. The sound here is stormy. You're in this channel. You're in a little dory. And you're paddling. And you're trying to keep that boat in the channel. And the wind is blowing. There's waves. You're trying with your every speck of strength you have to keep in the channel. You're absolutely focused on the light. And you know the channel is really dangerous. But that light is all you see. We're not thinking about distractions. We're not looking any other direction but the light. Because if we lose the light, we're lost. So we're in the little dory. Now I want you to imagine behind us a whole string of other little dories. And there, behind you, and they're looking at you and learning how to follow the light themselves. And I challenge you to be pure and transparent. So when these little dories who are following you look at you, they don't see you blocking the light. They see through you to the light in front of you. I challenge you, be that person. Because eventually there's going to be little dories following them and learning how to follow the light because of them. That is teaching. So get the fire in your heart right. Let it be Jesus Christ and only Jesus Christ. And then your students will learn to follow the light. Another little thought here, the second point here, a fire to be useful must be controlled. We know what forest fires are. They're sweeping the mountains and they're destructive and they hurt people and they hurt property. We also probably all use some form of fire to get here in the morning, our internal combustion engines, which is just a fury of fire. And in that engine there's tension and pressure and heat and friction and boundaries and stability and discipline. And by doing that, it becomes useful and beautiful in our lives. So we want to light a useful fire in our students' lives. And in order to do that, we have to show them boundaries. And that's what I want to talk to you about this morning. I want to talk to you about discipline. I want to talk about lighting a useful fire in your student's life. How can the fire we light become something that will help the student be valuable to the kingdom of God? Igniting a useful fire takes a tremendous amount of work and discipline. We must show them this discipline so that they can be useful fires, not less than they could be. We're trying to help them become all that they can be, not less than they could be. So that's what we're going to be talking about. And I owe this next section, so a lot of the main points here that I've built off of, to Jordan Peterson in his 12 Rules for Life, his first book. I recommend you read that book, especially the chapter on don't let your children do anything that will make you dislike them. And so I have some quotes in here too. I'll try to tell you when I say things that he said. But a lot of these thoughts I borrowed from Jordan Peterson and added different things. So first off here, as a teacher, are you setting out to be a teacher or a friend? And these are two very different things. We sometimes are afraid our students won't like us if we be the teacher. Because being a teacher has to do with discipline and control and sometimes causing them discomfort. And we feel like if we are that teacher, then our students won't like us. Sometimes we want our students' friendship so badly that we sacrifice our principles to get it. But I want you to remember, your child in your classroom already has a lot of friends, but he only has one teacher. And if you just add to yourself to his list of friends, see, friends are wonderful and they're great, but they have a very limited ability to correct you. Your friend has a pretty limited ability to come to you and say, you know what, Aaron, what you're doing there is wrong, and enforce a discipline in your life. He can't really do that. Teachers must learn to tolerate being unpopular. It's going to happen. You're going to do unpopular things. You're going to make unpopular decisions, and you're going to have to learn how to tolerate that. We must make tough decisions in your classroom. Remember, you're preparing your students for life. We're preparing them how to relate to people, rules, and structure. And you're preparing them how to build the kingdom of God. It is an act of responsibility to discipline your child. And I apologize because I have a tremendous amount of material here, and I'm just going to sort of go through it, and I'm going to go through it one time. And if I would have had an ounce of sense, I would have gotten you all handouts, and here you could just be having these handouts. But I'm sorry. I just can sort of dump it all on you, and the Lord will take it from there. It is not anger at misbehavior or revenge for a misdeed. This discipline we're talking about is a mercy. It's a combination of mercy and long-term vision. That's the kind of discipline we're talking about. Proper discipline requires tremendous effort for a number of reasons. Number one, it's really hard to pay attention all the time. You've been there in your classroom, and sometimes you're like, could you just give me like 5 minutes to think? But it's always something. And it's a pressure all the time. Lunch, recess, there's never a break. So that's one reason it's hard. And it's also really hard to figure out what's good and bad all the time. Did he mean that as a bad thing, or is that something I should let go? It's decisions, and all day long, it's hard to know what to do. And it's hard to make compassionate decisions that benefit the child all the time. It's sometimes really easy to make decisions. Well, we make snap decisions, and it's often more about our comfort and frustration than it is about our child. How do we make compassionate decisions that will benefit the child? And sometimes it can be hard agreeing with the parents on the right method of disciplining your child. But you want to do that. It's the parents' children. You get on their side. Find a way together. Don't just butt heads. Actually, because it is such hard work to discipline properly, a lot of modern people today sort of opt out of discipline. They say, you know what, this idea of restraints and discipline is harmful to a child. You know what? Let's just let him sort of grow as a plant, you know, without boundaries. And that is lazy and inexcusable, because a child is a little bit like a blind person. And he's in a room, and he's looking for a wall. He's looking for stability, and so he walks, and he reaches, and he touches until he finds that wall. They're not born knowing where the wall is. They're not born knowing where the right boundaries are. They don't know what is acceptable. And they will seek the boundaries more and more desperately until they find them. Violently and desperately. Some children more than others, and I think we've seen that. You know, in the grocery store, this child shrieking, violent, monster of a child, desperately, wild-eyedly, looking for boundaries. And nobody in his life is loving him enough to give them to him. Give your students those boundaries. So I've seen in every classroom I've ever been in, this student knows the boundaries often, or he thinks he does, but he's going to check again and again. And so he does something. You know, he does a little something. And it's bad, and he's looking at you as the teacher. And pray to God that you see, and you look back at him, and you can just smile or shake your head, and there's his boundary, right? But if you don't do that, if not given a boundary, he has to take a step further, and it's got to be louder and more violent, and he's going to keep going until he finds that boundary. And just saying, if you give him a boundary early in their in this whole classroom experience, your classroom will be peaceful. And it'll feel nice and comfortable in there instead of these violent flopping arounds looking for boundaries. So let's just think about the noise level in your classroom. So for me, noise is a big deal. Some teachers can have a lot of noise. I can't, right? It's distracting for me. So my classrooms tend to be really quiet. I mean, there's normal noises and shuffling and papers, but they can't whisper. I can't. Some teachers can do that. I can't do that. You can't whisper in my classroom. So first off, how does this look in your classroom, this whole boundaries thing that they're going to be testing again and again? First off, figure out what you're comfortable with. How much noise can you have in your classroom? Then tell them very clearly what you expect. So you know what? We're not going to whisper in this classroom. We're also not going to just slam our textbook shut. We're not going to drum our pencils on the table because I can't handle it. My mind shorts out, right? Once you tell them clearly what to expect, require them to obey your boundaries. That's probably, you have to require it, and that's very important. This is going to be a great, great gift to their lives, not only in understanding discipline, et cetera, but also in what the acceptable amount of noise is in a classroom of learning people. You know, when they go and do classes other places and this and that, they know that when you go to a class and you're learning, you sit still and you listen and you look at the teacher. What a gift to give your child. I mean, outside of the whole learning to deal with discipline situation. So other things, getting work done on time. How many times do you need to go to the restroom? I don't know. Not as many times as some people do, I don't think. You know? If it is, there's maybe, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's, I don't know. So remember, we're preparing them to live a useful life. Teaching them the discipline it takes to stay in that channel. Remember? Because to stay in that channel requires everything. It requires God, everything plus God. And we're preparing them to stay in that channel. So Jordan Peterson said so wonderfully, he said, without correction, a child will not go through the work necessary to learn to control his impulses and limit his actions. Without correction, a child will not go through the work necessary to learn to control his impulses and limit his actions. So we're trying to help them limit their own actions and their own impulses and their own. But it takes correction. It takes boundaries for them to be able to do that. We all need discipline and we all need punishment to become all that we can be. One of the ways that to bring discipline into someone's life is to reward good behavior, right? We know that. But how does that look in a classroom? So we're rewarding good behavior. First, figure out what this good behavior is that you want to reward. So many times we just want our children to have be wonderful, and we don't specifically think, what is the behavior that I want my students to do? What goal do I have for my students? Figure that out first. Then pay close attention to your students. Watch them, analyze them, think about them when they're gone. Pray and think and try to understand what's going on in their lives. And when you, as you analyze your students, when you see them taking a right step, reward it. So the last number of years, I've mostly spent teaching English to children who don't learn English, who don't speak English. And I love teaching English to these children. It's so much fun. And you have to do this. So my goal with these children is to teach them how to speak English, right? That's my goal. So I listen for their steps in the right direction, and I listen really hard. I set them up for success. I try to engineer something that'll help them succeed and be able to speak English and feel good about themselves. I set them up for that, right? Make the scenario work. And I praise them for even a failed attempt, if they tried. Give them affirmation, help them. We want them to succeed. And then reward them with food. I love food. And I love food in my classroom. And you know what? Students love food too. And food is a huge part of I don't know, my classroom. We have picnics and we get together and we do things and we cook and you know what? It's an immediate thing. They need it. It's, of course, in Bangladesh, they actually need the sustenance. But that's a good reward. Food. Maybe a little light on the candy and heavy on the chicken, maybe. I don't know. But. And also take times to find ways to show your children that you love them and that you approve of them. You know how it feels when your child comes to you and whatever it is and gives you this little note and something like, I love you for a teacher, you're my favorite teacher, or I mean whatever, blah 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 blah. Something inside you just, I don't know, it's really wonderful, and you feel it and you never forget it, right? And you and they it's the same with you. Take the time to tell them that you really love them and show them that you love them, that you approve of them, and that they can succeed with you in your classroom. It's not this hopeless thing. They can succeed. Take the time to do that. Don't just assume that they know that. So, but while we know rewarding good behavior is a great tool, it will not fix all your problems. More than likely, it's never fixed all of my problems. Negative emotions, things like pain, are actually also really good teachers. We all learn, from the old man to the youngest child, we all learn well from a hot stove. We touch it, and it hurts, and we don't touch it again, right? Pain is a tremendous reinforcer of things. It's because pain hurts that we don't do it again, which is pretty simple. We do our children, and this is another Jordan Peterson idea. I don't think it's a quote, but it's an idea that he gives. We do our children a great disservice when we do not use whatever is available to help them learn, even if it might be uncomfortable for them. We do ourselves a great disservice too. Our goal is not to shelter our children from hard knocks and painful things, but instead to teach them right ways of behaving when the hard things come. I think we understand what I mean by this effective discipline, but I want to illustrate a little bit by looking at the alternative. And this I find myself doing. I think it clarifies maybe what I'm talking about a little bit. So let's say Ted is a bad sport in games outside. We know it. We see it at recess. He had another little tantrum, and he's being a bad sport, right? We see, but for whatever reason, fear, laziness, etc., wanting to be popular, we don't push the issue, right? But it affects us, and it makes us as the teacher a little short with Ted, right? He comes into class after middle recess, and you're actually really ticked off at him. You know why? aggravating guy in soccer, you know, and I'm actually a little bit steamed up. So he raises his hand and asks an innocent question during class. And we take the opportunity, as hard as we try, to sort of brush him off and make him feel small and make him feel dumb. It's our tendency sometimes. Maybe it's not yours, but I do. I find myself doing that. So now Ted is hurt. He really is hurt because he loves his teacher, right? And now his teacher's making him feel like an idiot, right? In front of his class. And Ted doesn't know why, right? Why did asking that question about what assignment is due, what did I do wrong, right? So you're not only not teaching him to be a good sport, you're teaching him, you're making him become angry and resentful, especially toward the people who could help him, right? Instead of redemption and healing, instead of learning to be a good sport, he becomes worse. And again, becomes estranged from the people that could help him. Why do we do that? It's the laziness or the fear of not disciplining properly for the action in the beginning that causes us to grow apart from our students in this way. You see, when teachers just want to be the good guy, and not be the bad guy on the playground saying, you know what, you are required to behave and to be a good sport and learn that. And when we opt out of this disciplining, the misdeed still affects us. And it affects our whole classroom. And it gets worse. Thankfully, they still have parents. And they still have other things in their lives to help them. But the parents might just be counting on us to help them with this problem. So, when we choose not to provide necessary boundaries and discipline, we are just handing them over to a heartless, judgmental world. Who will teach them those same lessons? Only a lot more cruelly. So how does this look in a classroom? Let's think a little bit about rules. We've all heard of Occam's razor, how less is more. The simplest way is the best way. The least to get the job done is probably the best way. Too many rules frustrate students, and they frustrate the teacher. Especially if you can't remember anything like me. So as few as possible. I think my very favorite classroom rules I ever heard is my brother Willie's. In his classroom the last couple of years, he had two rules, as far as I know. Work hard and be nice. Such awesome rules. And on that, you can build a class. Everything sort of fits into that. Anyway, very, very important to decide what to do when a rule is broken. They need to know the boundaries of what happens when a rule is broken. I think punishment should be this is my personal opinion, I believe punishment should be the absolute minimum needed to get the job done. That's my belief. To over-punish somebody to do a good job so that maybe it won't happen again next time, I don't think is the right way. That's my personal opinion. Because guess what? If we don't get it quite enough on the first time, real good chance we'll have another opportunity. And we can maybe do it a little better that time. But it's like putting salt on your egg in the morning. You can put a little more salt on, but it's really hard to scrape it off. You know what I mean? So think, what do I need to do? What's the minimum necessary to redeem the situation? And then we do that. And if it doesn't work, we do a little more. But don't just blast them right away. So I think there are maybe four steps type of thing that you can use in the escalating minimum force necessary for your students. If you're paying attention, you're with your students, and you see a wrongdoing, usually a look, often not even a stern look, will get them back on track. You know, they're doing something at their desk, they knew it was halfway wrong, and they realize there's sort of this silence descending on the classroom, and they look around, and oh, there's the teacher looking at them. And often you can just smile at them, and you don't even have to glare. And they behave themselves. But sometimes you might need to do a stern look. So first, often a stern look is the first good step. A verbal command, number two, is the next level. And in a healthy classroom, a verbal command is a pretty powerful thing. If you're always bellowing at your students, you don't have a lot of... your verbal command means very little. But when you have a good relationship and you're catching these problems early, I'm saying a word like, you know what, Fred, that's not what you want to do. That really works. And maybe if he continues, the loss of a privilege. See, we're upping the ante. You know what? I think you're going to have to not be able to do that. You know what? The rest of the students can have, you know, water bottles at their desks, right? Because why should they be thirsty? But maybe because of what you're doing, you don't get to have a water bottle until you learn to, you know, not thump it all over and spill it on your neighbor, right? So they lose a privilege. That's the next step. And then the fourth thing, we could think of more corporal punishment type of thing where they get physical pain for a misdeed. But if you do this right, it seems like you very, very rarely need to go to the corporal punishment. In a healthy classroom, I think it should be very rare. Now, children are different, and each situation is different, and you can work through that however it needs to be worked through. But try the little ways early in the misdeed so that they don't you don't need to go to the corporal punishment. It's very important to catch the wrong behavior early so the punishment can be small. You see, as the misdeed gets bigger, the punishment has to be bigger. So if you catch it early, it can be small. And these next thoughts here, they're in my own words, but they are. This is also from Jordan Peterson. You're going to get tired of me saying that, probably. Teach your students what no means. No is a beautiful word. It's a freeing word. It can be, correctly. No must be backed up with consequences. It must be. When no is not backed up with consequences, we are teaching them that no from an adult doesn't mean anything. And we set them up for terrible consequences later on. We must teach them what no means. Because you know when that policeman comes to them and tells them no, it's not just a policeman. It's the entire United States government behind that policeman. And so many times God uses people to tell us no, right? And at the end of the day, often God is sort of behind that no. And if we can listen to the no from a person, even when we don't completely understand it, God doesn't have to bring in the bigger guns. Such a gift. No is such a wonderful, beautiful gift you can give your students. So teach your children no. We see the world around us looking at no as sort of a bad suggestion often. With very little meaning. Don't let that be you in your classroom. Don't avoid the conflict that is necessary to stop bad behavior. You cannot avoid that conflict because there will be conflict, there will be pressure, there will be pain. Don't avoid it. Because if you do, the problem only gets worse. The noisiness in your classroom gets more and more out of control. The bad language gets worse. The bullying continues. The bad sport becomes more and more violent. The cheater starts lying about more and more things. And the disrespect starts to include more and more people. Little quote by Jordan Peterson. If we don't do the dirty work now, we are only leaving the job to someone else. Someone who is probably dirtier than we are. I really like that quote. If we don't do the dirty work now with love and care, as somebody who loves these children, we're letting it. We're leaving that dirty work to somebody who might be really dirty and really hurt our children. Remember your allies, the parents. Your parents are your greatest ally. They can help you win these struggles. and they want to help you win these struggles. They are on your side, and they want their children, your children, to learn discipline. So keep on the same team as your parents. And remember how broken and incomplete we ourselves are. Be introspective. Pay attention to what we say and what we think. We have a tremendous capacity as teachers, as human beings, to be harsh and arrogant and vengeful and deceitful and angry and unforgiving. We have that inside of us. And just because we don't want to be that way doesn't mean it isn't inside of us. None of us, not a single teacher that I've ever met, has set out to be a bad teacher. But you know what? Bad teachers happen all the time, right? These things, if we don't give them to God, become monsters that control us. We have a great capacity for evil as well as good. It is okay to like and dislike things about your students. This is part of the reality of teaching. But it's also important, I think, to share those likes and dislikes with other people, namely the parents of the student, and maybe a trusted co-teacher, because sometimes we need a second opinion. We need another perspective, because sometimes these likes and dislikes are really important, and dislikes. And sometimes maybe there's something that is wrong with us. So it's okay to like and dislike things about your students, but try to get more perspective on that. Our goal is to prepare our children for a full, useful, and effective life that is a blessing to others. So we try again, day after day, again and again, to lovingly show them what boundaries are and how to be socially acceptable. And how to follow God with your mind and your soul and your strength. To keep in the channel. We need to constantly assess ourselves and our children and seek the help of God to find the next right step. We will make mistakes, own them, apologize, and do better. So simple yet so hard. We love our children in our class, but sometimes the things they do make us not like them. And that is, again, a thought borrowed from Jordan Peterson. It is their actions that make us not like them. And interestingly enough, the same actions that make us not like them often make other people not like them. So it's really important to help them with those actions, So that they don't mar the beautiful plan that God has for their lives. Don't give up. This teaching is a marathon, much more than it is a sprint. Don't just focus on what a child is, but instead on what he can be. You know, a bird in the spring, he flies over the forest and he sees in the weeds, in the trash, in the detritus on the forest floor, he doesn't see trash. He sees the opportunities to build a home and a nest. And him and his mate go down there and they take that trash that is useless because they see something else in it. They see a home and a safe place for a family, and they build a home with it because they saw it with different eyes than I see it. And tremendous challenge. So, as you begin the school year, ask God for these things. There are three things here. First one, the first one is this: to purify and heal you so that you can truly reflect Him to your students and lead them a little along the right way. So to purify and heal you so that you can reflect Him. And again, I want us to think about that channel and the light and us not obscuring the light, but making the light more visible to our students. But that takes God, raw, undiluted God, to make that happen. So first, to purify us and to heal us so that we can reflect Him. Second thing I want us to pray for is the gift of wisdom and courage to provide good boundaries and redemptive discipline for your children. Solomon asked God for wisdom. I think we as teachers pray for wisdom all the time. Dear God, please give me the wisdom and then the courage to provide good boundaries and redemptive discipline for our children. And the last thing I want us to pray for, and well, you are going to want to pray for way more than this, but also to pray that He will give you His eyes so that you can see His children as He sees them, so that you can see them clearly. Not what they are or appear to be, but as God sees them, as the beautiful people that they can become. God bless you so very, very much as you go and model Him to your children and lead them a little along the right way to Him. You are dismissed.